there's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
What's up, Bondus? This is the Desi Condition. I'm Tanushree.
Hi, everyone. This is Anu. And Tanushree and I are back with a really special episode today with Bushra Malik, who is the creator of BD Sex Education. This is going to be a really, really awesome episode, something we haven't done before. So I'm going to hand it over to Bushra to introduce herself.
Thank you, Tanushree. Thank you, Anu. Thank you both for having me here today. So as you know, my name is Bushra Malik, also known as Bushra Appa, and I'm the founder of the first sex education platform offered entirely in Bangla.
Yeah. Do you feel like your Bangla's gotten really good because of it?
Yes.
It's like some really tough Bangla. I have the reading proficiency of like probably an 8-year-old. I try to read your website sometimes when I'm practicing. So that I can learn all the things I don't know.
That makes me so happy.
It's really hard for me.
No, that's all right. Listen, I mean, I think it's tough because you have so many people in the diaspora who grew up, you know, maybe not learning Bangla to the best of their abilities because their parents are trying to, you know, get used to living in a new country and learning English, and they want their kids to blend in. I mean, Bangla was my first language. I was in ESL until the first grade. So, which is English as a second language. And, you know, it was really important for me to have all of the content strictly in Bengali or in Bangla itself, because I don't think those resources are available. And if they are, it's, you know, it's not really intimacy based or as explicit as the content here in the States are. My Bangla has definitely improved. And I think part of the reason is because the way that I interact with users is a little bit convoluted. So if they message me in Bangla, then what I'll do is I'll do Google Translate. And Google Translate is strictly in Shuddha Bhasha, which means like, quote unquote, proper Bengali. And it's so funny because that's how my dad used to speak. And my mom did not really speak that way. And so now I find myself saying things like Korechi Kechi instead of Korsi Kaisi, which means I did that, I ate. But you can see how different the sounds are. And it's also interesting because I'm learning so many words that I didn't know before. I mean, I didn't know the proper word for penis in Bangla. We're never taught those things, right? And I mean, it's true, right? Like, except for maybe Nunu, which I feel like most of us knew about as kids and would just laugh at. So it's a really interesting journey, like not just sex ed itself, but also learning so much more about the language. And I am trying to read and write. I can't. I have a couple of books that I've purchased and I'm trying my best. And sometimes it's really tough because you have to balance everything. But I'm definitely improving. So
that's great. Yeah. I mean, I can't read very well. I can understand fluent, whatever, I can speak, but reading it is hard for me. And it's so interesting what you learn in your profession when you're actually using Bangla professionally, because I sometimes do too, because I have a lot of Bengali students in my high school. So I like talk to their parents in Bengali. They're from Queens. So it's like a lot of Bengali immigrants who maybe don't even really know English. So that's been useful for me to like learn Bangla. But your website, you know, it's obviously I'm not the target demographic. So me not knowing how to read Bangla, like it doesn't even matter. But tell me about your target demographic. Why do they need BD sex education?
So my target demographic is really just people who speak Bangla. So you can either be, you know, someone who's part of the diaspora but doesn't speak English too well, an immigrant who newly, you know, emigrated to the States or the UK or some other country, right? I mean, there's so many Bangladeshi immigrants throughout the world. You know, whether you're from West Bengal, if you're from Kolkata, or if you're from Bangladesh itself. And it was really important. So the demographic is really just people who do not have access to important sex education information. And there were so many experiences in my life when I realized that we need some sort of tool like this. And don't get me wrong, I'm certainly not the first person to create something like this. I mean, there are folks out there who are part of grassroots organizations who are in the front lines. But what I did was I centralized everything into a website. And it's always a work in progress because there's so much more that you have to add to it. But as far as the demographic goes, I mean, like I said, the couple of instances when I realized that we need more explicit information, I'll give you an example. I used to sublet my apartment So, you know, when we were in high school, when my sister was in high school, I was in college, you know, my parents separated. So to help make ends meet, and this is something that I'm very open about, because I think in our culture, we're so protective of the things that we go through. And I think sometimes it helps to share these sort of experiences. So to help make ends meet, my mom subletted one of our bedrooms to a gynecologist from Bangladesh. I first knew something was off when she would laugh at the word penis. It would make her uncomfortable. And I couldn't help but think, you know, if you're a gynecologist, if you're someone who talks and discusses, you know, a patient's sex life with them, I don't understand why you would be laughing at that particular word.
Oh my God, you guys can't see my face right now. I just look like there's dung under my nose. That's so unprofessional.
I know. And to think that this is a woman who treated patients, she also had no idea that you can contract STIs, sexually transmitted infections or diseases from oral sex. She didn't know that oral sex was a thing. And that's really hard. It's really hard when you have all of these medical professionals in Bangladesh or just people in charge who also don't have the information because they were never taught these things, right? So, you know, one of the counter arguments I often get is, you know, our parents didn't need this, so why do we need this? Like, why do I need this information? Why should I teach this to our kids? And the way that I see it is that, you know, science every day is improving. There's so much that we're learning, not just about science, but health and mental health. I mean, one day, right, you're not going to need, if somebody has heart disease, they won't need open heart surgery. They might be able to, you know, fix their problems a different way. And I think knowledge is power, and we need access to this sort of information. You know, when a woman contracts an STD and she doesn't know that her husband gave it to her, you know, that's a conversation that we need to have. When people don't know that you can get STDs from unprotected sex, right? And we have to also prepare our kids. You know, as soon as you have children, we have to have the good touch versus bad touch conversation with them. How is a child supposed to know that they were touched the wrong way when we never explain to them that no one can touch your breasts, no one can touch your butt, no one can touch your genitalia area? We have to have these conversations. So, you know, I really think that the taboo that surrounds sex education, it's really worsened the issues that we're facing today rather than progressed us forward.
So you're touching on a few things that I was wanting you to get into in a second anyway, but can you tell us what really fits under the umbrella of sex education?
Everything. I think everything falls under sex education, especially from the moment that you're conceived to the moment that you die, right? So when you're born, your gender identity, that's a part of your sex education, right? As you're getting older, having the conversation with your parents, what is good touch, bad touch? We have to have these conversations with our children. There's a lot of abuse, sexual abuse that happens within the South Asian community that gets brushed under the rug because we're not empowering victims. And I don't like to use the word victim. We're not empowering kids or people on the other side to understand what's happening to them, right? Understanding your body, that's power, that's empowerment. You know, puberty is a part of sex education. So when a boy's, you know, voice gets deeper and he has the growth spurt, when a girl gets her period for the first time, and again, there's nothing wrong with getting your period. It should not be stigmatized, but for whatever reason, it still is. So we have to talk about this. We got to normalize this. And then, you know, of course, the inevitable conversation where you can't date your whole life, but suddenly they want you to get married and you're expected to know how to consummate the marriage. I mean, you know, if I grew up in rural Bangladesh, I've never touched a guy's body. A man has never, he's never touched a woman. How are we supposed to consummate the marriage if we don't know, right? How do we have kids? How do we have kids? How do we have sex to have children? You know, the fact that there are certain times of the month where you're more likely to get pregnant than others, you know, people don't have access to this conversation. And then don't even get me started with, you know, growing older and the issues that come with your personal sex life. I mean, intimacy, is very important. And it's such an integral part of relationships that people sort of brush over. But healthy, good sex is a really integral part of any relationship, especially in marriage itself, right? Because, again, I have to highlight that in Bangladesh, you know, it's a largely conservative Muslim country. So I am mostly talking about heterosexual couples, heterosexual married couples. But this information is meant for everybody, no matter your gender identity, no matter your sexuality, whatever your faith may be. But I'm just talking about the demographic that I largely serve. You know, when a man has erectile dysfunction and he doesn't know why, you have to start asking questions. Well, how old are you? Do you have heart disease? Do you have high blood pressure? I can't even begin to tell you the number of Bangladeshi uncles I know who are diabetic, have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and all of these things affect your sex life, right? And then you have menopause and you have these other issues that affect your health. Sex education really is a public health issue. It affects your health. It affects you, yourself, your body, but it affects everybody around you. Because if people in your community do not understand how their bodies act or why certain things are happening to their bodies, then that's a misinformed, uninformed community. And in order to empower ourselves, we need to understand these things. And, you know, sometimes it's tough and, you know, I want you to interrupt me anytime you feel, because I can just go on and on. But sometimes it's hard because I think people assume that I've been called like an atheist, feminist, Westerner. And, you know, I am a feminist and I am, you know, from
those
the West.
Those are such horrible things to be called.
I mean, whatever. I've been called far worse, but I can get into that later. But, you know, what it comes down to is that I don't think sex education is a Western invention. I think sex education, having access to the education surrounding your body, that is a worldwide necessity. That is a human right. You should understand your body. You should understand, you know, sex education overall, because again, like I said, it is empowering and this is a public health issue. And that's how I'm really trying to frame this.
I have a question. So why a website? I think I was the most curious about that. I definitely understand the need for it. And I also understand why you fell into it and it, you know, but why a website? I think it's very unique and I would love to know the story behind it.
That's a good question. So the reason I created the website is because it did not exist before. And I didn't really create it because I wanted to be the first. I created it because it just didn't exist. There is no centralized sex education website, you know, and it's interesting because sometimes you will find things on Facebook or on YouTube. And oftentimes it's always, there's a fine line, right? There's a fine line between discussing sex education and a sort of clinical or practical matter, which is what I try to do. And again, I'm not a clinician. I call myself a sex educator. I am working on potentially becoming a sex therapist or a counselor at some point so I could provide one-on-one counseling. But I try my best to speak about sex ed in a sort of objective manner. And what you'll have is, you have these YouTube channels or private Facebook accounts where you just have a bunch of horny guys talking about sex in a sort of misogynistic, almost sort of vulgar type of way. So I try to practice that fine line. But, you know, the purpose for the website is really just to have one central place where everything is saved. I want people to be able to look at it and get information. I want people to look at it and just see that everything is there. I mean, there was no, like I said, there's no central place. But to also to support that, to supplement that work, I know that a lot of people in Bangladesh are not going to read through the whole website, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, you have people, you know, it's a largely impoverished country. And even though it's economically improving, you know, I can't imagine someone would have the time to read through each webpage where I'm talking about different STDs in a clinical manner. I mean, a lot of the information that I pulled is either from the CDC, the Mayo Clinic, NHS. So it's all of these, reputable sources simply translated to Bangla. I mean, of course I changed some of the wording, but it's mostly just, especially for the diseases, direct translations. But to supplement that website, I also created a Facebook page and an Instagram page. And the Facebook page has been doing really well. And the reason for that is because Facebook is like auntie and uncle central. Like that's where if our aunties and our parents are not at a dawah or if they're not at like a house party, they're probably scrolling, you know, Facebook and being like, hey, take a selfie. You know, it's such a huge part of South Asian culture. And I knew that if I made a Facebook page, this would be one way to really get that information out there. And since launching it in December, I'm close to 16,000 followers now, which I think is pretty good for 8 months. That's about 2,000 jump per month. So I know that I definitely have the capability of growing this page into the millions. I mean, one of my posts had a reach of 1.2 million. So the interest is there. The interest is definitely there.
One thing I want to comment on is, and we spoke about this when we connected a couple of weeks ago, but sex education in the South Asian community is equal to shame. Shame is the first thing that I think about. just hidden, secrecy, taboo. These are the words that come to my mind when I think about these things. So as you went about creating this website and pulling these resources, did you at all think about the reception of this website and how people would react to it negatively or positively? Or did that just not even matter to you? You just wanted to go ahead and create this?
You know, the thing is, I had the idea to do this for maybe 4 or 5 years. I've had this idea for a long time. And it was because of that shame that I never created it sooner. Right? I always knew that this was a great idea and I wanted to create it. But, you know, I'm also a firm believer that everything happens for a reason when it's supposed to happen. And had I created this website 5 years ago, maybe I would have been too scared to cover certain topics, right? I was younger, so maybe I didn't know how to put a website together the best way that I know how to do now, right? I mean, most of my career has been based in media, marketing, communications. I've worked in city agencies. So these different jobs really gave me the skills that I needed to create this website and, you know, create sort of this marketing plan to push this information out there. But the shame, you know, the shame certainly stopped me. And I was really scared. I was scared for a long time. I was scared of like being called all these terrible names. And then I think, you know, when life hits you hard and certain things happen in your life, that's when you realize, okay, I just have to move forward and do what I got to do. And there were a few things that had happened to me, right? So I lost my dad suddenly in 2019. Rest in peace. And, you know, that was really tough because he and I had an estranged relationship and he was really abusive, which is something I'm really open about. And like losing somebody like that is tough for multiple reasons. The first reason is because you mourn the person, you mourn the father you wish that he was, but then you also just mourn his death overall. And that was really difficult for me. And it made me realize, it made me come to terms with my own mortality. And then directly after, we had the COVID pandemic, which is still ongoing. And that was really tough. And, you know, I think seeing a lot of jobs, and I'm not talking about any particular job that I worked for, but just in general, seeing so many people who have these, you know, high, crazy titles, you know, none of that ultimately matters because we're all going to die anyways. So if I have to be on this earth for 70, 80 years, God willing, then I'm going to do what makes me happy and I need to do something that I feel like means a lot to me and will help people ultimately, because this is a service. And something that is really important to me is that no matter what career I'm in, I want to serve a population. And for the past 7 years, I've been serving the city of New York, and now I'm ready to serve my people back home. And I have been here in the city, you know, in New York City, but, you know, I'm willing to be sort of that sex ed martyr that teaches women how to, you know, understand their bodies and understand what the clitoris is and realize that pleasure is not a bad thing. And, you know, explain to guys like, hey, you think your penis is not big enough because you're over consuming porn, right? I'm willing to be that person who has these conversations because I think dealing with those deaths and that trauma and also just dealing with the South Asian community in New York City, I mean, they're going to call you a hoe anyways. They're going to judge you. They're going to judge you no matter what. And I think the sooner that Bengali, Indian, Sri Lankan, whatever your ethnicity is, I think the sooner women realize that they are going to say bad things no matter what, and you just fulfill your dreams, you just go for it, you know, things will get a lot easier. And I just went for it. And I forgot about the shame because whatever. I'll be a, there's that really popular saying, it's lajjashoromnai, which means they have no shame at all. And you know what, if you think I have none of that, that's totally fine. Cause you know, it's just me. It's not me. I don't really care about what the aunties have to say. Not anymore.
That was really inspiring.
Oh, thanks.
I think about that a lot. Like whenever I'm about to do most things, I'm like, how am I going to feel about this on my deathbed? Am I going to regret this? Am I going to regret not doing this? And that's kind of how I weigh the decisions in my life. What am I going to regret?
Oh, 100%. You miss all the shots you don't take, which is a real thing. I mean, you know, and I think also with getting older, I mean, I'm 31 this year. Mm-hmm. And I feel like as soon as I hit 30, I didn't think about a clock, because I think in your 20s, you think I have to be successful immediately. I just graduated college. I need a 6-figure job. And that's not at all how it works. And I think once I turned 30, in culmination with everything else, I was just like, yeah, I don't care anymore. I'm just going to do me. And
that seems to be happening quite a bit at 30. I'm realizing people are just like, fuck it. I'm just going to do the thing that I fucking want to do.
Oh, yeah. 100%. 100%. And I'm a huge fan. I love it. And you know, you see it in older people, too. Like, I think sometimes we don't give some of our aunties enough credit because you'll find... like sometimes older family members will find themselves again and do things that make them happy. And it's such a nice feeling, especially when they surpass that survival mode of their life. So, you know, I think it can happen at any point. And that's what's so awesome about life itself.
I don't know about you guys, but I felt like my mindset in my 20s was so narrow-minded, in a sense where I wasn't thinking about how different I would be in 10 years, 20 years, like 30 years, however long I'll be on this earth. I honestly thought that who I am now is who I will be in the future. And I was so, so wrong. And then when I turned 30, I mean, I'm also turning 31 this year, actually in a month. It clicked for me and I realized that I'm going to evolve if I choose to evolve. And I think that was kind of one of the stepping stones to really just like break free of those barriers.
Yeah, they call it a growth mindset.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know what's funny? I don't know if you guys have your Facebooks, but I always think about deleting my Facebook, and then I'll look at the Facebook memories and I think, oh my gosh, all of these old gems, I cannot delete these. And I had a status once. I wrote the status and it said, Bushra Malik is going to graduate at 22 and get married by 25 and go to med school and have children. And I share it every couple years just saying, LOL, who was I think? What did I think I was?
I can't bring myself to delete Facebook either. There's too many gems in there.
There's things I'm embarrassed about, but I want to know. I want to know about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're not embarrassed about things you posted about 10 years ago, then you did not grow as a person. That's all I got to say.
That's a problem. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
So your Facebook page for BD Sex Education is popping, right? What are some of the common issues or themes that you see?
Oof. Where do I begin? Well, one of the first issues that I really came to terms with that's been tough is that the people who largely follow and like the page are men. Which is obvious because I think it's more commonly accepted for men to have an interest in sex and sex education overall. And that's been really tough because I do want this to be more normalized within women. And I was thinking, how do I do that? So I'll get to that in a second. But that's been one of the biggest issues, you know, trying to get more women to follow the page. And that is part of the reason why I also talk a lot about a lot of women's issues. You know, I think one of the most interesting things that I really also had to come to terms with were my own internal biases. So, for example, as often as we want to talk about men who are not so great and guys are trash and, you know, there are plenty of those. But having, you know, men who looked very traditional in traditional garb message me and say, how do I make my wife orgasm? I want to make my wife comfortable. A man messaged me within the first few weeks of opening the Facebook page, and he said, I'm getting married for the first time. My wife and I are both virgins. How do we have sex? How can I make her comfortable? And when I tell you, I almost wanted to cry, and I thought, oh my gosh, you're such a sweetheart. And I try to keep it very objective, but that was also tough for me, right? Because I never thought that I'd have to explain step by step, this is how you have sex, because it's not just penis and vagina. It's, you know, the intimacy of getting physically close to each other, kissing, hugging, you know, first base, second base, having to explain first base, second base. And then you have a largely Muslim population. So they ask you questions like, is oral sex halal? And is swallowing halal? Like, these are questions I'm getting that I would have never anticipated. So, you know, I'm forced to face my biases. I'm forced to also get a little bit uncomfortable in the way that I answer things.
How do you answer that?
Whether or not it's halal?
Yeah, it's question. Any, I mean, you can pick from any of that list of questions. How would you answer that? I'm just so curious how you approach that. I am not at all equipped to answer something like that.
No, that's fine. I mean, for that particular question, it is halal to have oral sex with your husband or wife in a heterosexual marriage. However, some
Some scholars say that it is not halal to swallow, while others say it doesn't matter because that is your husband or wife. So that's the thing. Everything's open to interpretation. It really depends on who you're talking to. But for me, as someone who tries not to insert her own personal religious beliefs into these conversations, I just keep it as objective as possible. That if you want to swallow or do whatever, safe sex is the most important thing. Make sure that you're tested, etc. But one common thing that I also found is that men and women both have different self-esteem issues for a plethora of reasons. And sometimes the root cause of that is really pornography. I had a woman who happened to be a Nakabi, which was very awesome for me, because I thought to myself, yes, I want more women from different backgrounds to reach out. And she asked me about the skin color surrounding her vulva. You know, it's natural to have darker genitalia. You have darker skin around your inner thighs. You have darker skin around your elbows. And she said, will my husband like that? Like, am I ugly? And I had to explain to her that, no, it's completely normal to have darker skin there. But who would she have asked? You know, she could have asked her doctor, but maybe she was thinking, oh, no, what if my doctor thinks I'm crazy? So, you know, here you have this random Bengali woman, you know, with this Facebook page. And you think to yourself, OK, it's almost like Ask Amy. You just ask these questions and I answer them.
Yeah, and especially in a culture where whitening creams are so common, especially whitening creams for genitalia, that's so big over there. Yeah, I love that she's able to ask you that.
Well, the worst part about it, honestly, is that there is an overconsumption of porn that happens in South Asia. And even though it's banned, you know, people find ways around it. And, you know, what is porn? Pornography is explicit imagery where typically it's not female pleasure centric. You have these people bleaching their assholes, you know, like obvious, and they're like fully waxed to a T. I mean, that's not what real sex looks like. That's not what real relationships are like. And then, you know, self-esteem issues, whether it's about the hair you have down there or the color of your genitalia, having so many men reach out to me who are worried about their penis size. And I don't even have to know that they watch porn because they want to grow up to 8 or 10 inches. And I think to myself, you only want 8 to 10 inches because that's what you see in the videos that you watch. But I don't explicitly say that. I just message them and say, your penis size is fine the way that it is. You do not have to take pills. I mean, there's a huge market. There's a huge black market for these crazy pills that people take, and that could really harm you. So, you know, having to also push for you know, taking charge of your health, not taking homeopathic medicine, unless it's a reputable source. I mean, you know, some homeopathy I think does work, but there are certain things where, you know, I don't think that pill is going to make your penis grow, no matter how many times you see that ad on Pornhub. So it's a lot. It's a lot that I've been dealing with. And, you know, I think sometimes the hardest part, you know, I've had people call me things like a magi, which means whore, and accusing me of having STDs, which I expected. But I think the toughest thing has been reading messages from people speak about their wives or their girlfriends in such a depraved way. And that's been really hard, you know, because sex education isn't just about sex. It's a lot of different intimacy questions that people have. And trying to maintain composure when I want to cuss the person out on the other side has been really tough. I mean, you know, Bangladesh, South Asia, we have a huge pedophile problem. And having a 26-year-old message me that, is it okay if I marry a 12-year-old girl? That was one of the toughest questions that I got. And, you know, I can put him on blast and I can cuss him out, but I realized that I have this platform and I'm here to educate. And it's so tough because, you know, if I just do that, if I just put him on blast, then other people who have that same problem of attraction to minors, they're not going to come to me. And don't get me wrong, it made me so angry, but it also made me realize how common this probably is, because the age of consent in Bangladesh is 16. That's still fairly young, especially since child marriage is a huge problem back home. But I mean, 12 years old, and I know he's not going to be the only person to ask me that question. So it's tough.
How did you respond to that?
I took a deep breath and I just said, you should never be attracted to somebody younger than the age of 18. Somebody who is 12 is a child. So I just put it in as simple Bangla as possible. You should not be attracted to somebody that young. That is wrong. Somebody who is 12 years old is a child. you should not be physically attracted to them. I think you should see a therapist or a psychologist. And then I asked him, I said, where do you live? Like, you know, if you don't mind me sharing, you know, what town do you live in Bangladesh? And then I look for psychotherapy, I look for therapists or psychologists, and then I share that with them because I think to myself, like, you need help. Another time I had someone, a man, talk about his wife, and he said, I'm going to say it in Bangla, but then I'm going to say it in English because I just want you to hear the exact language that he used. He said, Amar bo ponchasher moton, ekhon bujhen o kemon dhila hoye geche.
Oh, God.
Yeah, which means my wife is around 50 years old, so now imagine how loose she is down there. And it made me so sad because I couldn't help but think, you know, this woman probably bore children for you. And, you know, I think there's a way to ask these questions. And the other question that I had is, when you say loose, like, what do you even mean by that? Are you talking about her vaginal canal itself? Or are you talking about her labia? You know, your labia changes throughout your life, right? And that's totally normal. And again, because of pornography, you make these assumptions about what labia is supposed to look like. No two women have the same looking, you know, vulva or vagina. We're all different, you know, and it's really, really hard because how do we have these conversations that explain to the masses that it's normal to have these different body parts? Because the minute you talk about it, you're a whore. The minute you talk about it, you have no shame and you're bad and you're trying to infiltrate these Western ideas. And, you know, girls in Bangladesh and boys and whatever, people in Bangladesh and just around the world deserve to love themselves and be proud of their bodies. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with having questions and trying to understand certain things. Another very common, which surprised me, another common sexual issue that I've come across in my messages is I have a lot of teenagers sexually attracted to their moms.
No way.
Yes. I have a lot of teenagers who've messaged me, and as terrible as it sounds, you know, I can see different layers of why that might be. The first is because these kids might not have access to people of the opposite sex in general, right? I mean, in Bangladesh, you don't really see women in public places that much, in public spaces. It's a patriarchal society. He probably watches a lot of porn. So, you know, what pornography, again, is a very unhealthy thing, and it's not ethical. So you're probably watching stepmom versus son porn and all of these very incestuous sort of themed pornography. And then, you know, you have these urges to have sex, and then your mom is there. I mean, again, these are just theories that I have based on you know, all the different layers that affect issues in South Asia, especially when it comes to sexuality. But that was a really common problem. And again, the same thing. I did not, you know, cuss them out or anything, because usually when people have problems like that, they reach out, they always apologize. They say, I'm so sorry, I'm so disgusted, please don't share this with anybody. So, you know, you do have a lot of people reaching out to me who have a lot of shame and they're really disgusted with themselves. And I think to myself, what good would it do for me to call them disgusting when they already know that? And I don't even think it's fair to say that. I don't think it's fair when something culminates because of the situation and the culture that you're in. I mean, there's a reason why. And again, I have some very favorite writers, and one of my favorite writers, her name is Mona El-Tahawi, and she's written a couple of great books. And one of my favorite was, I believe it's called Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. And I highly recommend you read it. But she talks about how when you don't have women in public spaces and you have a largely heterosexual population, and men, you know, people want to have sex, but they can't have sex and they're not having, so they resort to violence, sexual violence, they resort to crime, and unhealthy sexual deviance. So it really is a direct result of not having women in public spaces. And that's also one of the biggest reasons why I won't say that I am a supporter of premarital sex, but I will always say that you should not get married only for sex, because marriage is a lifelong commitment. It is beyond sexual relations. It's much more than that. So that's something that I try my best to explain to people without trying to hurt their religious sentiments. Because it's true, marriage is far more than sex. And the other thing is, you know, I'm not here to tell you to date around, but I think we should normalize male and female friendships and just being in public spaces together, so that when you do see a woman for the first time, you're not ogling them like they're a piece of candy. And you see this all the time. You always see this in videos. Like, you go to Bangladesh or India or Pakistan and you're the only woman in the market, you're gonna get groped, you're gonna get leered at. And that was honestly one of the toughest things I had to deal with when I went back to Bangladesh for the first time when I was 16. You know, I mean, I was a developed young woman, I had these C-cup breasts, and just I'll never forget the way people looked at me, like I was this, you know, naked person when I was covered from head to toe. I'll never forget those stares. And I'm sure my experience is not uncommon at all.
Let's take a quick break from our episode. If you've listened this far, that means you probably like what you're listening to. So why not leave us a rating or a review, hopefully something nice, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts? And tell all your friends about the show, because you probably don't know this, but The Desi Condition is 100% run by people who do this as a side hobby. I myself, the founder, am a high school math teacher and a graduate student, and everyone involved either goes to school or works full time. All of this to say that TDC thrives on word of mouth only and doesn't make any money. And we're not trying to make money. We just want to spread the good word about mental health and wellness. So please take a moment to text your friends about this podcast or leave a rating to support the show. Let's go back to our regular content.
I actually wanted to ask you about just some of what you said, which is interesting that you brought it up, but something that I have found just dealing with South Asian men is this feeling of being objectified as like a baseline. And I say this with South Asian men in particular, because it's been a running theme in my life throughout all the years that I have dated. I feel like with my experiences with them, regardless of whether I got intimate with them or not, I felt as though they had this sense of entitlement and this sense of objectifying women because they didn't know any better, or because they didn't understand what intimacy actually was. And so some of what you just said really does make sense. And there was one guy in particular that I spoke to that mentioned suppression being one of the reasons. He was really open about it. I had asked him, I was like, why do you think this way? And he said, honestly, I just feel like I've been suppressed, and now I'm this adult man, and I don't know how to change, and I don't know how to think any differently. And, you know, despite that situation just being quite like disappointing for me, I had some compassion for him. But I want to talk about that. And I wanted to know about you guys and your personal experiences and just how you navigated those situations.
That's really hard, right? I think one of the biggest issues is like in those, I think, personal relationships where women are objectified. I mean, that always stems from the home, right? I mean, you have these young men, you have these boys growing up where mom does everything. And even when she's not a stay-at-home wife, she's doing everything instead, right? I mean, even my mom, like, I'll never forget, she used to work at a daycare, or she used to work at Burger King. She would come home and she would always get so pissed at me because I would forget to soak the chicken, like defrost the chicken. And it's so funny because now I think back and I'm like, God, I was such a little shit. I know why she was so mad at me all the time. But, you know, she would come home like 8 hours a day working, and she was expected to still cook and clean and look after us. And, you know, I think when you're a boy, or, you know, when you're a male, you grow up seeing this, and it's, you know, nothing is being questioned. It's just sort of as is. Women are sort of seen as not a person, but something that you use. And that goes beyond someone that you use in the kitchen and someone that you use to clean the home. This is someone that you could simply just fuck, and that's it. Right. And excuse my French, but that's sort of just how I look at it. You know, even from pornography, even from just sex in general, like guys are expected, men are expected to know about sex to some degree. But are they expected to know how to also help a woman orgasm? I mean, they get theirs in 2 to 3 minutes, and women are left there self-DJing maybe half an hour later out of shame because she's just like, well, I deserve to orgasm too. So I think these this analogy of how women are used in the kitchen or used at home, that's also how they're used in the bedroom, right? Because I think about this all the time. I'm like, you know, like, did my mom ever, and this sounds, I'm so sorry to put it this way, but I really sincerely mean it. Like, did my mom ever orgasm? Did my grandmother ever have pleasure? Did all the women that we know who are probably so angry all the time, I mean, if their husbands
only last 2 to 3 minutes in bed and do not offer these pleasurable experiences and these intimate experiences. No wonder they're uptight all the time and they're always upset. So I think, you know, this patriarchal society that we're dealing with, where women are always second class, that resonates to what's happening in the bedroom because our pleasure doesn't matter, you know. And I've dealt with that BS before, you know, and it wasn't necessarily somebody who was South, you know, someone who was South Asian, and it's not a current relationship, but, you know, being told things like you take too long, you know, like, how long are we going to do this for? And it's just like, geez, you know, women deserve to also finish. And I think sometimes, and again, I try to teeter this really fine line because I don't want people to know too much. And again, maybe it's because I'm still sort of young. So maybe when I'm older, I'm going to be like, yeah, I'm going to talk about all the relationships that I've had. No problem. You know, I mean, they're going to call me a hoe anyway, so who cares? But what I would say is that, you know, the sexual relationship that you have with your partner is going to be really reflective of your relationship overall. So if you're in the bedroom with somebody and he's not willing to take an extra 10 to 15 minutes to eat you out or help you finish, then he's not going to help you around the house, sweetie. Right? Like, it's just, everything comes hand in hand. What is love? Love is giving and taking. And that's what it's like in the household. You give and you take. I, you know, if I'm cooking, I want you to clean the dishes. If I'm putting, you know, if you're setting the table together, you know, if I'm cleaning one room, you clean the other. And it's the same thing in the bedroom. I give, you take. You give, I take. It's just, that's what pleasure should be like. It's a consensual, healthy relationship. And unfortunately, you know, we have a lot of these issues because of the way our homes are set up. And it's a huge problem. But again, I think the fact that, you know, three ladies were having this open conversation, I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, our moms having these conversations with each other. I mean, we're breaking these barriers just by having these conversations because we're learning from each other and, you know, you're learning more. And I hope that, you know, we have a lot of young women listening to this conversation and also young men and just people in general learning that, there's so much more to intimacy. There's so much more to relationships and there's so much more to understanding yourself and your body.
I think a lot of people need to listen to this conversation and just realize that it's okay to not know something and no one's going to judge you for it more than you judge yourself.
Oh yeah. 100%.
So much of what you're saying, I feel like the first world needs sex education too. Like, without a doubt, there are girls in the first world who don't know what a period is until they get it and they think they're dying. Like, how often have you heard that story from even your friends who grew up here in America?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, I dealt with that too. I mean, I didn't know what a period was when it happened. I didn't know. I remember thinking I can't use a tampon because I'm going to lose my virginity.
Yeah, that was common. Right? That, like, was common in swim team.
I thought that.
Actually, I was on swim team in high school and a lot of girls, that's what they said. And so they just wouldn't swim for the competition. So I ended up covering a lot of girls in the pool because I was like, I don't care. I'm going to wear a tampon. I need to swim. But a lot of girls, they just wouldn't because they thought it was a, like, virginity thing. And it just, so you can't lose your virginity to a piece of cotton. I'm sorry, babe.
I know. And it won't. Excuse me, but the tampons are not long enough to also break your hymen. And also, right, breakage of the hymen does not equate to whether or not you're a virgin.
Right.
And virginity is a construct, but I'm not even going to get into that.
That's a whole other conversation. Oof. For another day.
Have you had children reach out to you?
Yeah.
What is that like?
And it's been great. It's like the best feeling. It's such a great feeling. I love it when kids reach out to me because it makes me think, yes, I'm explaining things to you.
That's awesome. Remember, what are they asking about? What are they curious about?
You know, it's very interesting because I've come to find that girls are always excited to talk to me and boys, especially teenage boys, will try to butt heads with me. You know, and I don't know if it's like the patriarchal
that
thing.
That literally, like, sounds like high one school. Boy. So yes.
Jeez, it sucks. I remember I had this like 15-year-old kid like writing these long messages to me, these essays about how sex education is so bad. And I was like, oh, sweetheart, you have no idea what you're talking about. And I would go back and forth a little bit. And after a while, I'm like, I have other people that I can message. But One of the best things I remember, I had this young girl message me. She was in the seventh grade. She asked me questions about her period. She asked me questions about pads. She asked me questions about boys. She asked me, you know, how do people have sex? And I just explained it to her. I said, you know, when two parents, when two people, when they have sex, this, the, you know, P and V, I explained that. But and she went on further, like, how do you have kids? And I explained that, you know, a man has to ejaculate into a woman. And I answered all those questions very objectively. You know, she asked me if she could have a boyfriend. And I said, and I always say this, I say, I look at their age and she was pretty young. So I said, maybe you should wait until you're a little bit older, because I also don't want to get ragged on by parents. I mean, if you want to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you're going to do it anyways. But like, I am Bushra Appa, and Bushra Appa wants people to wait just a little bit, you know, but I want you to know what you're doing when you start doing it. And she wants you to wear a condom. Please wear a condom. So it's nice. I love it when kids reach out. I love kids so much. I can't wait to be a mom someday. And I always think to myself, I'm like, oh my God, it's going to be so weird, like, having me as a mom. But even my mom, she gets so stressed out. Like, I can't even begin to tell you how stressed she was when I was doing this. And she was like, and I only like to say things in Bangla sometimes, because it really embodies like the spirit. But she's just like, tomar post korar age ami pura website ta porbo, which means before you post it, I must read the whole website. And I'm like, all right, if you have all the time in the day. So I created a thing and I had Mama Bush read the whole website.
How did she like it?
And she was just like, okay, this is okay. You know, I think she's proud of me, but she's just
has so to be disapproving just to keep up his appearances.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm not wearing it right now, and I think it's because I'm really comfortable with you too. We've had a couple of conversations, but sometimes I have this clitoris necklace that I wear, and listen, the clitty is powerful. But anyways, I have this clitoris necklace that I wear, and I wear it for interviews or just certain things where I feel like I could use a little more strength, because again, powerful. And my mom is always like, "Tumi oi vagina thing kinishta pore aso," which means you're wearing that vagina thing around your neck. And I'm like, first of all, it's not a vagina, it's a clitoris. And I think it just makes her so mad. It makes her so anxious. It's fine. She'll be over. But I know she's learning. That's the thing. She won't tell me to stop because she's learning. And it's so nice to have these open conversations with her. I mean, you know, she talks about her birth control journey with me now. And she talks about how, you know, she would always make my dad wear a condom because she did not want to get pregnant and she was not comfortable on the pill. And that's such an interesting thing to learn about your mom, because you don't think, oh, my mom used to have sex or might still have sex at some point, because our parents absolutely deserve to have healthy sex lives too. And it makes us uncomfortable to think about these things, but you know, they're living people too. They deserve to feel loved. So it's interesting to see that even 20, 30 years ago, we had to tell guys to wear condoms because they say they can't feel it, but you'll feel the clap later on, right? You'll feel that burn.
So listen, we've talked about kids reaching out, older people reaching out. We talked about religion, marriage, pornography. What I've only slightly touched on is sexual abuse. So I guess my question for you is, how do you approach talking about what sexual abuse is? I'm going to give you that question specifically for if children are in the picture or if there's someone reaching out who you believe might be an abuser.
That's always really tough because I know it's happening and it's happening all around us, unfortunately. In our community, when a child comes out and says that they've been abused, usually we brush it under the rug. And the way that I handle it really is, first and foremost, I really haven't had anybody reach out to me that they've abused children. However, if they have reached out to me with an interest in marrying a child, then I would think that maybe this is somebody who is an abuser and probably has abused somebody. I haven't had people reach out to me about being abused. And I think part of the reason is that a lot of times when you have been abused, you might not realize that you've been abused. a lot of abusers, especially when it comes to children, they sort of treat it as a game. Like, oh, we're playing a game, but you can't tell your mommy and daddy. And that's when the abuse happens, which is really disgusting and unfortunate, but it is something that's a reality. And I very often, I would say every 1 to 2 weeks, I'll post a good touch, bad touch diagram where I explain these are good touches. So, you know, kissing on the head, a shoulder touch, the holding hands even is okay. But then I clarify what a bad touch is, you know, no kissing on the lips, no touching of the genitalia, etc. And what I've done is I've also, to talk about sexual abuse, I've brought up cases that happened in Bangladesh and even one that happened in New York to talk about how abuse is prevalent and how we could target, how we can essentially try to get rid of this problem. You know, in Bangladesh, there were a few high profile rape slash abuse cases that really brought my attention to how important sex education is, because, you know, the solution to rape in a country is not killing all the rapists. It's about talking about consent with the rapists and the boys who would grow up to be a rapist. You have to talk about consent from the moment kids are kids. You know, keep your hands to yourself. You cannot touch anybody else, right? So I remember one of the cases that really shook me was the murder of Nusrat Jahan Rafi. She was a young woman. She was a high school student. She went to an Islamic school in Feni, Bangladesh. And I believe she was murdered in 2019. And what happened was her principal forcibly kissed her and groped her. And I think she was maybe 17 or 18. But she did the right thing. She went to the police. And the community turned their backs on her and instead supported the principal because, you know, this is a revered imam in the community. And he actually ordered for her murder and she ended up getting lynched. And, you know, reading that story, it really broke my heart because it made me think, oh, my goodness, this is somebody who was sexually abused and she was supported by her immediate family. But look at the way that the community turned their backs on her. Here in New York City, you know, there was this one case of a young woman named Samiha Khan who jumped off the 7 train platform in Queens, New York, and killed herself because her father molested her for years and abused her. And, you know, nothing came of that case. Mm-hmm. Nothing came of it because none of the newspapers covered that death. Yeah. And the one newspaper that did cover it alluded to the fact that she was having boyfriend problems, which is an absolute insult because that was not the case. Her father was abusing her and no one did anything about it. And I hope that in my lifetime that he can be prosecuted. You know, if no one else pushes for it, I will continue to push for it because no one can get away with something like that. But the other thing is, I know a lot of boys. I know a lot of Bengali boys who've been molested. And I think the reason is because our community is so gung-ho about protecting little girls that we forget that boys can also be molested and raped as well. So you have this hidden population of young men who've been molested as children, but they won't open up about it because there's so much shame surrounding it. There's so much taboo. So, you know, the way that I handle this is really just continuing to push out and give the information, having those conversations with your kids, good touch, bad touch. And, you know, I think people who are abusers, they know that they can't do something like this. That's why they do it in secrecy. So that's why we have to push out the messaging that, okay, parents need to talk to their children. Parents need to trust their kids because a child will not lie that they've been touched a certain way. That's not something that kids would do. And explain to them what good touch, bad touch is. Regularly have these conversations. So should something happen, you know, you can contact the authorities and go to the right officials to get the help that you need. I know it's a lot.
It is a lot. And then what happens when those same people come to America? Maybe the consequences won't be as intense as getting lynched, but still don't believe you, still let those people enter your home and et cetera, still go to whatever mandir or masjid or church or wherever it is that you're going to. Like, you just keep apologizing and allowing this thing to keep happening. I know.
You know, most recently, I feel like what happened in the Catholic Church, where you have all of these stories shared about you know, priests who abuse little children. I think that's something that's been happening and ongoing, especially in Bangladesh and madrasas, and, you know, it happens in mandis as well. But because these crimes are so disgusting and they're taboo and they're hidden under the rug, I think it's only a matter of time before we see a huge wave of young boys and adults coming out about the crimes that they've, about the abuse that they witnessed and were a part of as children. You know, unfortunately, I think in a lot of communities and a lot of religious communities, these people in charge hold a lot of power and they're revered. So if they do something wrong, they're just going to continue to do it because the community is too afraid to speak up. If one person speaks up, that's not enough. You need the whole community to speak up in order for that person to be targeted, in order for them to be canceled and prosecuted and, you know, and booked. But that's not going to happen until the community organizes together against the perpetrator, against the abuser. And the only way that can happen is if we change the narrative that we have to support the abused, which oftentimes are innocent, helpless children.
Yeah, we have to accept how often it happens so that we are more inclined to believe it when it does happen, when somebody in your real life comes up to you and tells you, hey, this is a thing that happened to me. I think this is a sad statistic about my life, and I'm sure that you both can relate. But I think almost every woman I know around my age has experienced some kind of sexual assault. All of my friends have, all of them.
Yep,
I have
me
a lot
too.
That have as well.
Really right. Sucks.
You need to believe how common this is. So one other question that I wanted to ask you about is, how do you approach sexual preference and gender identity?
So that's been really tough. And, you know, I do have a webpage dedicated to LGBTQ issues. I am trying to include gender identity, but it's really tough because, like I said, this is a largely conservative country, largely Muslim. But again, there are queer Muslims that exist, and there are many who will argue that, you know, queer culture, you know, being LGBTQ, this is the way God made us, so this is accepted. And, you know, I do agree with that. But at the same time, I need to be mindful of the population, and I have to slowly segue to that sort of thinking, right? I mean, when consent itself is not a black-white issue in a country, Lord knows how long it will take for them to accept, you know, the idea that homosexuality is totally normal. And I've gotten a lot of flack for that, you know. And the thing is, I want to share a lot of information about this, and I'll continue to keep it on my website and do posts on it. But I also have to be mindful of my safety, right? I mean, I believe it was in 2015 or 2016, there was a man named Zulhas Mannan who was the editor-in-chief of the only gay magazine in all of Bangladesh, LGBTQ magazine, excuse me. And he and one other person, one other staff member, Mahabub, I forget his last name, but the two of them were executed in Bangladesh because they wanted to hold. Yeah, because they wanted to hold a pride rally in Dhaka. And it was so heartbreaking because there are a lot of queer Bangladeshis. I mean, you got a population of 160 million people. You don't think that there are some gay people there? Like, you know, you don't think trans people exist? I mean, we also have the hijras. We have the third gender identity that we already accept. So, you know, the idea that other gender identities cannot be accepted is really mind-boggling to me, considering that we're already a little bit forward when it comes to accepting hijras themselves, right? So I'm hoping to do more posts in that. It's just I'm trying to be mindful and strategic with the way that I push forth with this knowledge and this information.
And so, from what I understand about hijras, they're accepted, sure, by society, but they don't necessarily have a high standing in society because there's still a lot of stigma surrounding their identity. So even though, yeah, we're forward in some ways, it's like, not enough. It's I know exactly what you mean. It's like, how are you? We can't even get past what sex actually is. How are we going to get to this more? It's not convoluted. I was going to say convoluted. Yeah. It's not a convoluted identity, but something that's just not so cisgender.
Yeah, and it's tough because the word that they use to describe hijras is also bagal, which means crazy. And, you know, I don't think that's a fair terminology. I mean, the other thing is the terminology isn't there, right? We're just learning about different mental health disorders that exist. And, you know, back in my grandma's day, I mean, my grandmother suffered from postpartum depression and everyone said that she was possessed by an evil spirit. So, you know, this is a community, this is a population that really just does not have access to information. And even if they do, I think the way that certain things are politicized in the current climate, they'll think, oh, this is being shoved down my face. This is evil. This is atheist thinking. This is Western thinking. So I do try to be mindful of that. And I'm trying to slowly segue into them understanding that this is not an atheist mentality, or, you know, I mean, it's tough. And again, I try to teeter that fine line and you know, be strategic with the way that these things are taught. I've often found that religiously,
if you could explain something and make it make sense, then South Asians will find their way towards accepting it. But culturally, I have found that there are barriers that just persist past generations. And when you guys were speaking about the hijras, that's a perfect example. Like, I'm Hindu. I grew up in a Hindu household. Hijras are very well respected, but in a religious sense. If we saw one, we always asked for blessings. We always gave them gifts, money. It was always a positive experience for us on the receiving end because they were supposed to be these holy people, quote unquote. But who were they as people in society? Yeah. I had no idea. Culturally, they were still the other, right? And like, until I did digging on my own, that's when I started to actually learn about their history. But prior to that, it was just, they're a group of people that mean well for us. Make sure that they're happy. Make sure you treat them with respect. Otherwise, they will curse you. So almost like some sort of like evil lived inside of them was kind of the messaging that was pushed
almost
down.
Almost like not that these are not human attributes that you're describing.
Exactly.
Even.
Exactly. So it really comes down to religious acceptance versus cultural acceptance. And there's just a giant gap between the two. And I found that so interesting because it's the same group of people, but you're looking at it from two very different lenses.
You know, I was raised Muslim and I call myself a Muslim, but some people would not call me a Muslim because of the way that I dress and, you know, my relationships and things like that. And I try to explain that religion, no matter what faith you follow, is not a monolith. Everyone believes in something differently, whether they believe at all. And I don't think your belief system should hinder you from accepting that there are different kinds of people out there who live differently and have different gender identities from you. So, you know, I think for me, I do need to learn a little bit more about different ways to explain that some of these things.
I can't imagine the
normal
emotional burden that you must go through on a daily basis, having to deal with these sorts of questions, because when someone thinks sex ed, they're thinking of all the fun things that are associated with it. But all the things that we've spoken about today are all very dark, traumatic, and very much a part of everyone's lives day to day, very real things. And were you anticipating that going into it?
I was. I didn't think I'd get as many dick pics as I get, but I know it's only going to increase. I get so many noodle pics. And you know what? I'm kind of used to it now, just a little bit. I'm sort of getting used to it. I'm going to be like, oh, that is your noodle? Okay. I mean, like, you think I'm going to get off on it?
I'll never understand that.
Right.
I will never understand it either. I mean, I do get it a little bit because I think it's terrible because I've been doing this for a little bit now. But it comes from a place of power. Like, oh, you are the sex educator. You must be a whore. Here's a picture of my dick.
Right.
And it's like, I'm not a skank. And even if I was, I don't want to see your dick. But, you know, it has been emotionally really exhausting. I have a wonderful therapist. I'm thankful to have a loving fiance and a great sister who is like I mean, she deals, my sister's on TikTok, so she's dealing with her own shit, right? Like trying to post silly videos or funny videos about dating, and people make assumptions about her. So I think having a sibling that I'm really close to who also understands like what it's like to sort of put yourself out there in sort of a different lens and sometimes get some pushback. I tell my mom, I will say my mom is actually really cool. I love her because I tell her all these things and she'll just laugh. Like I told her about how someone sent me their penis photo. So I won't post the penis pic to Facebook, but I'll post their name and their photo and say, this man sent me a penis photo. And my mom's like, oh, let me see. So I think, you know, I'm so thankful for the people in my life who've helped me sort of push forward. And I'm going to be honest, I am taking a little bit of a break. So I think since creating the site, I've probably answered more than 15,000 individual inquiries. But it's just me, myself. I have a couple people in Bangladesh that I pay monthly to help translate content on my behalf. And, you know, I keep their identity secret just for safety purposes. But it's a lot to take on. So I took a break from answering questions individually, and I'm really focusing on building out the website a little bit more, maybe creating some PDFs, getting on TikTok, because Busha Appa needs to be seen, right? I mean, I really want to, you know, I don't call myself, yeah, like I'm not an auntie yet, but I want to be that auntie, you know. I want women and even guys, but like I'm a girl's girl. I want like girls to look up to me and just be like, I have a question about my boobs, or a boy's treating me this way. What should I do? And I just want to give advice and be like, you know, just keep pushing through. And I wish what I'm doing is I'm trying to become the person I wish I had growing up, because I think if someone like me existed when I was 14 or 15, I would have not made all of the mistakes that I did, or I would not have wasted so many years worrying about what if, you know, and being shrouded in shame for absolutely no reason. I mean, shame is so, And this is a direct quote from a doctor that I once interviewed. She's wonderful. Her name's Dr. Rumana Mansoor. I interviewed her for a Bengalis of New York piece, and she said that shame is very isolating. And, you know, it's really tough when you're growing up and you're developing, especially as a young Desi woman. And, you know, your whole life until puberty, you're like this free thing. And then suddenly you grow a pair of tits and everyone's freaking out and you have to wear an extra sweater. So, you know, you carry yourself with shame for a really long time until one day you turn 30 and you're like, you know, I don't really care anymore. So sometimes I feel like I'm entering this new wave, this new age of my life, and I'm eternally grateful and I'm eternally thankful for it. And I hope you guys, I hope you two feel the same.
I definitely,
you
know, do.
This is
100%. Definitely. Yeah. 100% feel that way.
Dirty 30 Club. always. Dirty 30, flirty 40s, fun 50s. Let's do it. We'll keep it going.
What is your self-care routine?
I love working out. I haven't worked out in a little bit, but like just for a few days, but I do lift. I love lifting. And the reason is because I feel like I like pushing myself, whether I am curling or I love deadlifting, because I physically feel so much better and lighter afterwards. I take all of that frustration that I have and I get rid of it. And, you know, it's also hard because I think all of the things that I've dealt with as a kid, you know, like growing up in an abusive household and seeing the abuse that like a lot of my friends also witnessed. And then reading a lot about sexual abuse and reading about all the atrocities that happen to women worldwide. I think, you know, the way that I handle it is knowing that there's so many people out there doing the work. You know, I think sometimes it feels like work isn't being done, but there's so many organizations, whether it be in Bangladesh or India or whatever country, there are people on the ground having these conversations, sharing these stories. I mean, the fact that, you know, you have people sharing about the things that they'd experienced, and something that's very interesting to me, and I think it makes people uncomfortable, but I always say that this is a really good thing. there are increased rape cases in Bangladesh. And I always say that I know it sounds terrifying, but this just means that victims feel empowered to come forward because these crimes have always existed. The difference is that when they happened before, we ostracized the victim. I will never forget watching when that when the Delhi gang rape happened on that bus following that case. I will never forget thousands upon thousands of women and men marching in the streets on behalf of that woman. And, you know, it made me realize, okay, people are understanding, people are opening their eyes to the atrocities that women and girls regularly face and boys, right? I mean, sex crimes will affect you regardless of your gender identity. So I take a lot of solace in that. So self-care to me is knowing that there are people who care. There are a lot of people who care. Exercising. And I like to birdwatch. That's the way I run.
I love that.
Yeah, I'm a big birdwatcher.
That's so cute. I'm an aspiring birdwatcher.
You are a birdwatcher. It's not a, you know.
No, I aspire to it because I just look at them, but I don't really know what I'm looking at. So I'm aspiring to it. I want to be able to like look and identify.
Oh, you totally can. It's so easy. I love birdwatching. I live in the Bronx, and the Bronx is a very wild borough. And I see blue jays and cardinals. I've seen so many hawks. I've seen bald eagles.
Bald eagles out in the Bronx?
Yeah, over Riverside Park.
I have no idea.
Inwood Park. I've seen so many. And, you know, the thing is, I think birds are incredible. I mean, I think connecting with nature helps me a lot. And I don't know if you two feel the same, but being in a cubicle and in front of a computer screen all the time, like feeling the grass or touching trees. Oh, this is really weird. I touch trees for wisdom.
Oh, cool. I love that idea. That's awesome. I want to do it too. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. When I see really big trees and I can tell they're really old, I just put my palm on it and I think, okay, all right, give me some wisdom because I know you've seen a lot. I'm really big into birding. And honestly, like I'm probably going to live on a farm someday. Like I think I'm going to have a farm and do my sex ed work from there and be like, leave me and my sheep and my goats and my cows alone as I drink unpasteurized whole milk.
Oh, I love it.
My mom likes to feed birds. That's her self-care routine. She makes a roti every day. A giant roti, and she'll put it out for the birds in the morning, and then she won't have her breakfast until they eat it. So she'll watch from the kitchen. She'll be like, okay, did they have their breakfast? Did they eat? And then once it's finished, then she'll have her breakfast, and it's just the cutest thing. That. So I feel like because of that, I'm always looking at birds also, but I have a special connection to pigeons. They're definitely my
pigeons. Oh my God,
that's
right. I forgot about this.
I love pigeons so much. I think they're actually little people in there. So when I look at them, I'm like, what is your life story? Like, what are you thinking? It's a little crazy. I get judged for it, but I don't feel judgment here.
It's not crazy.
It's funny because it's random. It's funny because it's random as hell.
It's so
like,
random.
I just did not know that about you.
No, a lot of people don't. No, a lot of people have no idea that I have a pigeon obsession.
And now it's public knowledge. True. Look at this.
It is. Put it out there.
You got Mike Tyson has his pigeons. Like pigeons
are so astute.
Incredible birds.
They're so astute. They really are. And they don't care. They don't care about you. They don't care about what you're thinking. Like they're so, I don't give a fuck. And I think that's probably what draws me to them. And I also find them to be kooky and just funny little creatures.
Do you think that there's a microcosm of pigeons specific to New York City who have evolved in their own way that is different from other pigeons in other cities?
Yes.
I think so.
Because Miami pigeons are not the same.
And I've heard that is the same for rats. Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I hate rats so much. I'm sorry. I can't. I know they are God's creatures, but oh, my God, I hate rats.
How are they different in Miami? I don't pigeon watch enough.
The pigeons in Miami are not as, I feel like they're a little bit more in tune with how, with people, as in like they're looking at you, looking at them. Whereas a New York pigeon is like, I don't care. Like I don't care that you're like 2 feet away from me. I'm still going to do what I need to do. As in, eat the little food that's surrounding your feet. So, you know, they kind of have like claimed their territory, but I feel like mammy pigeons are still a little like, oh, like, you know, there's a person next to me. I don't know if I can go there. I don't know if it's safe. Oh. And also they look a little bit more like, they look a little bit more like subtle. So they have
fear in their hearts.
Yeah. They look a little bit more subdued. They're like a little bit more like, what's the word? Submissive. Like they're just not like out there, but the New York pigeon is just like, this is my world. You're living in it. Like, that's just the vibe that I get from them.
That's not wrong.
Which I love so much. Yeah. See, I have a whole theory.
No, listen, I'm all about talking about the pigeons. I mean, like I said, we can grab dinner. Maybe we could do some birding and some beer.
I gotta,
some
birding and some gotta get all the birding spots from you in the Bronx. And then we gotta go birding.
Yeah, we'll go to the Bronx. We'll do it. Listen,
I think on that beautiful note, maybe we'll end this right here. Do you have anything else to give us for advice or little known facts or anything that we haven't covered on this episode about you and your fantastic endeavor with sex education?
Oh my gosh. I think that, you know, human life is really powerful and it's really sacred, and knowing your body is a really sacred thing. Don't care about what aunties have to say to all the people listening. Do whatever makes you happy, because we're going to die anyways. I don't know. We had a really long conversation. So if people get to the end of this, like, pussy power always.
I had to giggle.
Let's follow my ladies. But listen, that's really just it. You know, just really believe in yourselves and everything that you've always heard. You know, it's all the stuff. But I hope that people's takeaway from this conversation is that, you know, you have all of these women talking about these experiences and people talking about these experiences who are older than you, and just really just listen to those conversations and try to take away from it, because it'll really help you. And I think listening to other people's experiences and learning more about what they've gone through will help you grow as a person. And I think that's really important. So, you know, Bushra Appa is happy to sign off, and I will be your favorite Bushra auntie someday.
This was awesome.
Thank you so much.
So delightful.
This was awesome. Thank you both. Thank you both very, very much.
That is the end of our episode, Bondus. We hope you enjoyed this, and thank you so much for joining us on this journey. If you'd like to reach out to us, we can be found on Instagram and Facebook at The Desi Condition and on Twitter at TDCPodcast_. You can also email us at thedesicondition@gmail.com or visit our two websites, tdcpodcast.com and, of course, our Desi Creatives directory at desicollaborative.co. Stay safe, stay warm, make good choices, and we'll talk to you next time.